Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to the show, and this week we speak with a wonderful woman, Maureen Santora, who's the mother of a firefighter who lost his life at the Twin Towers on 9/11. Maureen shares memories of her son Christopher and what it means that Bin Laden has been terminated. Our gardening expert Tara Nolan is here to give some pointers on spring planting, and we also speak with Carol Ingley, a high-tech expert on how to navigate the world of gadgetry. Also, a killer remix is on deck from Lady Gaga and her hit song Judas.
Capture your need for sound.
With the recent killing of Osama bin Laden, it feels like a big step towards the end of a really dark chapter that began on a bright blue day in New York City, September 11th, 2001. Since that very tragic day, we've pinned a lot of hopes on terminating this man, but now that he's gone, now what do we do? How do the survivors of 9/11 feel? To help answer that question, it is my honor to welcome Maureen Santora. She is the mother of Christopher, a 23-year-old New York City firefighter who lost his life on 9/11. Maureen is also a 9/11 advocate, a speaker, and author of the books The Day the Towers Fell and My Son Christopher. Maureen, thank you so much for joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Maureen, before we get into the after effects of bin Laden's death, can you please tell us about Christopher and how he was called to that horrible scene on September 11th, 2001?
My son was working the night before in his firehouse, Engine 54, and we expected him to come home on September 11th around 9:15, 9:30. We live in an area that's very close to Manhattan, so he, you know, was able to get back and forth, you know, quickly, and we expected him to come home. And from our window, we could see the Twin Towers. We saw the second tower be hit by the plane. The first tower had already been hit, and we saw both towers collapse. But around 9:15, we got a call from Christopher's firehouse, from his lieutenant, asking that he return to work, and we knew he was down there. At the time, you know, I think most families, other than the ones that, you know, had members on their, on the airplane or in the buildings, just assumed that their loved ones had survived. It was incomprehensible that so many people would just disappear. So, you know, I expected Christopher to come home, and I expected him, you know, perhaps he was hit on the head and, you know, had amnesia, and, you know, we called all the hospitals, but I expected him to come home. It didn't dawn on me for quite some time that he could possibly be dead from this. So, it was a very, anxious day, but for me, I expected my son to walk in the door.
And when did you sort of realize that Christopher was in trouble and maybe not coming home?
Well, it took me a very long time. I had a memorial service on November 2nd, and it was on that day, you know, we went down to Ground Zero and, you know, with all 15 families who died, you know, from Christopher's firehouse. And only one firefighter had been recovered, and he was found 3 days after September 11th and identified as Jose Guadalupe, the chauffeur of Engine 54. And he was buried at the beginning of October, and you know, our family started to have memorial services. But I, you know, held out hope until November 2nd, and I said to my daughter, he's not coming out of here alive. And so we had to plan a memorial service for December 1st, because my husband was in the fire department for over 40 years, and he knew most of the guys who had died and, you know, had vanished. And so on December 1st, we planned our memorial service, and 3 days before the memorial service, we got a call from the medical examiner, and they came to our house and said they had made a terrible mistake. They had buried our son in somebody else's grave, and the grave he was buried in was Jose Guadalupe, the very first firefighter's funeral that we, you know, attended, and the only firefighter from Engine 54 that has ever been, you know, recovered and identified, and it was actually our son. For me, that was my miracle. I got my son back. I was able to bury him, and there were still 1,123 families who have never had any identification whatsoever. And I needed verification that my child was, you know, down at the site. So that, for me, was a miracle. And, you know, we had gone to Jose's funeral, which was actually Christopher, you know, the beginning of October. And, you know, the rest of the families from the firehouse expected that they were going to find, you know, the other guys. They found all the men from the ladder company the end of March, but they've never found anyone from Christopher's engine company. He's the only one that's been identified and recovered. So it was, for me, a big turning point, because I was able to begin my journey to healing, knowing that he was actually down there and that, you know, we had part of his body. You know, most families never got the whole body, but they got parts, so we did get parts. So,
and after, you know, realizing that you did have part of Christopher and you know, you were able to have the memorial service, Maureen, I think for a lot of us who, you know, we're not directly a part of 9/11, you know, a bunch of us up here in Canada and obviously the rest of your citizens in the United States, we have no clue what you've been through. You know, I mean, I know I felt on a cerebral level just pain and anguish for all of you, even though I physically and emotionally didn't understand. How was it like moving through the following days and months after the tragedy? Were you in shock? Did it take you a couple of years to sort of settle down, I guess, or because you were able to recover, Kristen?
Well, the first year after September 11th, we had a lot of ceremonies and we had a lot of remembrances. And, you know, all of us, you know, got through these, you know, wonderful tributes. Firefighters came from all over the world and paid homage to the ones that had died. And there were a variety of remembrances and services. And so the first year was not as hard as the second year. The second year for myself and my family in particular was very, very difficult, because all of the, you know, remembrances were now over. And the realization, you know, although we realized that Christopher was never going to be at the table and never going to be part of our dinner, and this was the most difficult time in my entire life. I don't think I will ever, ever recover from this. But both Al and myself, my husband, decided that we were going to be activists and we were going to speak out on injustices, and we needed to really take a look at what had happened. And for me, as an educator, I really believed that we needed to, you know, find the lessons, you know, that came out of 9/11. And so we began, you know, to work at that. And I ended up writing, you know, 3 children's books, because I wanted to teach children the effects of hatred and what it did to our entire world. Prior to 9/11, things were very different, and now we have generations of children that don't know anything else. They know about the high security, they know of the suspicion, and they know about, you know, the division that Osama bin Laden perpetrated. And so, you know, it was important to me to teach those lessons, that in each of our little worlds, in the playground, in the park perhaps, or, you know, in our little neighborhoods, we could create a kinder, more loving environment in our own little worlds. And if we did that, you know, across the board, we'd end up with a better world. And so that's what we started to do. And we also spoke out on a variety of issues that, you know, occurred after September 11th. We are still fighting things that we feel are unjust and unfair. And unfortunately, most of the families, you know, have not been included in a lot of the decision making regarding the new memorial and the museum. That has been given to a select few of about 20 families, and they've made all the decisions but not shared them until after the fact. So we decided we were going to be activists, and we were going to try to right the wrong, as it were, if we could, and speak out so that other families would be able to have a voice. And my son was a very proud American. He was very, very proud to be an American, and he was outspoken in an American history buff and knew a lot of facts, you know, about our country, which is unfortunately not common for young people, you know. And he was very, very outspoken in a lot of areas, so he no longer had a voice. And so when we spoke, I felt that we were speaking, you know, with his voice. And I'd hear him in my head, you know, getting crazy at what was going on in the world and stuff. And so when I spoke, I always thought of things that he would think or he would say, and, you know, and I spoke, you know, for him because he was no longer able to speak.
Joining us on the show is Maureen Santora, the mother of a very brave 9/11 firefighter. She's also a 9/11 advocate, speaker, and author of the books The Day the Towers Fell and My Son Christopher. Make sure to check her out at www.maureensantora.com. Maureen, when you were actually writing the books, was that therapeutic for you as well, or was it a difficult process to go through?
Well, I wrote both of the books within the first year of September 11th, and I put them aside, and I didn't think about them for several years. And when I went back to look at them, I was very pleased at what I had written, and I made a decision, you know, to have them published, and it was definitely therapeutic. Writing allows you to speak from your heart what you cannot say in words. And, you know, The Day the Towers Fell, I mean, they're both, you know, children's books, but they are written in such a way that children are not horrified. I didn't want to scare children. I wanted to tell them what hatred created and what it did to our world and how we can, you know, we have the power to change that. And in My Son Christopher, it's the story of my relationship with my son as he was growing up. Also, you know, for children. And I wanted kids to know that their parents love them unconditionally for their entire lives. And even if they get into trouble into school, which Christopher did, and they weren't always perfect, and Christopher was not a perfect child, it didn't matter. I loved him because he was my son. And I would have supported him and stood up for him and helped him. And if he needed to be reprimanded, I felt I needed to do that. But that was all done because I loved him so much. And I wanted kids to know that it's not important to be perfect. It's important to know that you are loved and your parents love you unconditionally. And I wanted parents to say to their children every day, I love you. You're special. You know, you don't have to be like everybody else. You know, you can be your own person. And whichever way, you know, you decide to go, I love you because you're my child. And so that's why I wrote the books, and it was definitely therapeutic. And I highly recommend that people who are in traumatic events write. They don't have to read what they write right away, but if they write their thoughts and go back to them later, they're now in a different place. And when they read, they see a vision of you know, how they were feeling at the time. And, you know, so it's a very therapeutic process. It's a very good thing to do.
And Maureen, now, you know, with the recent termination, I guess we'll put it that way, of Osama bin Laden, does this or has this opened up old wounds for you? How do you sort of, I guess, feel, you know, and internally, where do you go from here? Because I feel like you probably have a very healthy outlook on all this, whereas I'm wondering if there's some other, you know, families of victims who have been pinning a lot of hatred on, you know, bin Laden and wanting to see him be killed. Now that it's done, I'm wondering how some of them are going to go forward, because it's like, you know, they might have been just focused on that for 10 years, and now what do they do?
Well, Osama bin Laden was the face of evil and al-Qaeda, and this organization took a very big hit when he was murdered, you know, when he was killed. And I wasn't sorry that he died the way he did. I was very pleased that there will be no place to memorialize him. I thought he was a tremendously evil force in the world. And for most of us, we're very well aware that even though he is dead, al-Qaeda still lives on. And so our job is not done yet. Our job to be vigilant and to be aware, and that goes for everybody in the world, and to watch out for these hate-filled groups kind of developing in their neighborhoods and starting, you know, in little areas needs to be, you know, addressed. And we need to work very hard and be very vigilant to make sure that this hatred is curtailed and terminated. And will we ever have a world that's filled with peace? I would love that to be. Whether that will happen, I don't know. But this was an intense evil that permeated our world for close to 10 years. And we really need to work very, very hard to bring it to its conclusion and to its end. So Bin Laden is dead, the leader is dead, but the organization still is intact, and we need to be very watchful, you know, because this is not a religious group. They are not doing this under the guise of following, you know, a God. What they are doing is they are perpetuating hatred and evil, and so we must work very hard. So I see, you know, his death as a turning point, perhaps, but the job is not finished.
Maureen, I have to ask you, with the 10-year anniversary coming up this September, does it feel different, or will it feel different now that Bin Laden is gone? And also, you know, I think a lot of people, or the media, makes it a big deal when it was the 5th anniversary, and now it's going to be the 10th anniversary. I'm assuming every year is hard. So does the 10th year differ from the 8th or the 4th year?
I think the only difference between, you know, the 1st and the 10th, or the 4th and the 10th, is the fact that it's a different number. For me personally, September 11th is a most difficult day to get through, because it's the day that my 23-year-old son was killed for no reason. I mean, he was not doing anything that he should not have been doing. In fact, he was trying to help people get out of the buildings. So for me, every day is, every year, it's very, very difficult. And we go down to Ground Zero every year, and we put flowers in the area where he died, and my family is all together, and we support each other. But it is a very emotional, very, very difficult day. I guess because it's 10 years, people are going to make a much bigger deal of it than they would have on the 8th, for example. But for the families, there is no difference, and there is no number when you are less sad and you know, grieve less. The best you can do is you cope better. You know that he'll be at September 12th. Whereas in the beginning, you weren't so sure that you'd get to September 12th. You were, you know, not able, you know, to think of getting to December, you know. And so with time, you've learned how to cope better with this loss. But the loss will be with us forever. And it will be with, you know, parents are not supposed to bury their children, and so this is not the normal, you know, scheme of things. And you're a different person. I'm a different person. And I, you know, I know that there'll be lots of politicians who will come down, and they will share their, you know, concerns and sympathies. And then the following day, they will go back to their regular lives, because they have not been personally, you know, affected. But for the families, there is no next day when you don't think about it. You think about it every day. And, you know, I remember my son with gladness, and I'm able to laugh now. I have grandchildren, and they make me laugh, and I think of things that my son did that they are now doing, and that brings me joy. And you know, accentuate the little joys in your life. On May 1st, when we heard that word that Osama bin Laden had been killed, I felt Christopher's joy that this evildoer had been killed. I felt it. And so I was joyful because he was killed. But I never wished for anybody to be harmed or murdered in my life. But I was joyful on Sunday night. And every day for us is a day when Christopher and his absence are part of our lives.
And something I wanted to ask you, Maureen, again, as someone who was not directly affected by this tragedy, you are now a part of a family that would have not been created if it hadn't have been for September 11th, meaning you and all the other victims' families. Have you found great comfort in other people, and those specific families? Because I feel like it's something that really only you guys can understand, or even, you know, victims from Hurricane Katrina, they're in a family as well, because it's something that they've gone through. Do you really feel like a connection to those other families?
Absolutely. Those were the gifts that we received, meeting these just incredibly wonderful people who we never would have had the opportunity to meet. And we do consider, you know, each other as family, you know, and we often say, you know, jokingly, we're part of a club that nobody ever wants to be in, but we're in this club and we're in it for life, and we connect with each other. And when we are in a group together and somebody cries or when somebody becomes emotional, we all understand why that person is doing that. And it's not for show, and it's just grief ridden, and people are able to be, you know, very free with their emotions when they're in the group of other family members, because we all understand, and it is a gift. And I treasure this, and I value every person that I have met because of September 11th, who is part of this 9/11, you know, family. So I feel these are the good things that came out of this terrible event. I wouldn't have chosen this, but these are the gifts that we received, and I'm very grateful for them.
And Maureen, where can people get a copy of your books?
Well, the books are currently being sold at Exlibris, xlibris.com, and the Day the Towers Fell and My Son Christopher are being redone for the 10th anniversary at Seeger, S-E-G-R, publishing.com. So they will be available in both of those places. And they're also available on Amazon.com and also in BarnesandNobles.com.
Maureen, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That's Maureen Santora, the mother of a very brave 9/11 firefighter. She's also a 9/11 advocate, speaker, and author of the books The Day the Towers Fell and My Son Christopher. Check her out, www.maureensantora.com.
Forgive sounds good. Forgive, I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price, and I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make forget. I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting.
For people who like to get outside and get their hands dirty in the garden, this is one of the most magical times of the year for you. We are smack dab in planting season. And to give us an idea about what we should be doing and trying out with our gardens this year is Tara Nolan, web editor for CanadianGardening.com. Tara, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tara, you know, tis the season for people to be, heading off to their local garden centers or nurseries. What sort of cool and interesting things should they be on the lookout for this year?
Well, there's a lot of really neat things at the nurseries. I've been to a few so far and have seen some previews. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting flowers and a lot of interesting plant material. One of the biggest, I think, because I was at a presentation in a, I went to my hometown garden show, and one of the presentations, there was a gasp from the audience because there was a slide of these black velvet petunias, and they're just so amazing looking. They're so dark. They almost look purple in some lights, and they're a great accent plant, so you can use them with yellows and whites and hot pink, light pink. I think they're a really neat addition to the garden. And then there's also the phantom petunia, which is black, but it has this really interesting yellow center.
And if people want to get like an idea, should they just go to the garden center or should they do some research online before they head out?
You know what? A lot of nurseries will carry different things. So, I mean, it's a good idea to have what you want in mind, especially as far as the color palette goes. Sometimes if I don't go organized to the nursery, I come away with nothing because I'm so overwhelmed by the choice that I'm not sure what to pick. So I think if you have a clear idea of what you want to fill certain areas with, you can still go without knowing exactly what plant you want, but as long as you know sort of how many and the palette that you want to choose, then you can sort of pick the new things that you might not be aware of and that you might not find online.
I think that's actually really important that you brought up the color palette business, because I think sometimes people, you know, they're so excited to get, you know, to the garden centers or the nurseries that they might not take that extra moment to sort of just go outside, look at the particular area where they want to put flowers and sort of get an idea. And I know that some people like to be willy-nilly and just be like, oh, here is everything. But then I think sometimes it does benefit the look of your place if you do have like a plan of action, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes I've seen some beautiful multicolored gardens where it looks effortless, but they've obviously, you know, taken some time to place things, you know, and but they all work together really well. But I don't know, I always like to change it up every year. So I always choose, you know, maybe a different palette, maybe a lot of pinks and whites and yellows or pastels. Other years I've gone with a lot of reds and oranges, you know, some of the warmer colors. So I don't know, I find it fun, especially with the annuals, to mix it up.
And when you're actually in the nursery, how do you read those plant tags? Because they confuse me and there seems like there's, you know, a lot of information going on.
There is. I think, you know, some of the main points on a plant label, you know, you'll have the name. So you'll have the common name and the Latin name often. But the important points to pick out are the exposure. So whether it needs sun, shade, a little bit of both. So it's important to make sure that you know where it's going in your yard. How far to space the plants apart. That's important too, because some are real spreaders, so you don't need to plant them so close together, because in a few weeks they're going to all fill in really nicely. And also just the height and the width, perhaps how much water it needs, and when it might be blooming. So some bloom a little bit later in the summer, and some, you know, are going to bloom throughout the whole entire season. So you'll get a good idea of that from the plant tag as well.
You know, just like there are good ways to pick, you know, fruits and vegetables when you're at the grocery store, I'm assuming that there are proper ways to pick a good plant from the nursery. So how would you go about doing that?
Well, there's a few things you can look out for. Sometimes it's really tempting to choose the flowers with the most blooms on them. But I like to look for the buds, because then you know that once you get it home, it's still going to continue to bloom for you. Another thing is just to look for spots on the leaves. That could be an indication of mildew or insects. You know, if you maybe move the pot around a little bit or you take it out of the, you know, off the table at the nursery and insects sort of go scattering in any direction, you know, that might not be a good indication of a healthy plant. Also make sure that it's not root bound. So if you see all these crazy roots coming out of the bottom of the pot and it's really sort of this tight wound up ball, you want to make sure that it's a little bit but it's in the proper size pot. So, you know, it might have gotten too big for the pot if you see a lot of wild roots.
I think that's fantastic. I would have never even thought about that, with it being in the wrong size pot and like all those crazy roots, and also the bug thing. Like, I think that's pretty interesting that you would sort of pay attention to that and know that maybe that plant, even though it looks pretty in the moment, it might not be a good choice for you to put in
exactly.
your garden.
Just going to also say to keep your receipts, because oftentimes, you know, if a plant doesn't work out, especially more so a perennial than an annual, but if it doesn't work out in the garden, then, you know, you can take it back and get your money back and pick something up.
Joining us on the show is Tara Nolan of CanadianGardening.com. Now, I know this is probably going to sound a little naive, but for us newbies to the garden, can you explain what is the difference between, you know, annuals and perennials, and which one is going to work best for us?
Sure. I mean, both work really well depending on your conditions in the garden. But a perennial is something that is supposed to come back every year. So over the winter, you're going to hope that, you know, it comes back in the spring and that it survives the cold and the frost and everything. And an annual is basically something you plant that's just going to last for the season, and then come the fall you can toss it in the compost bin and then start over next year.
And with regards to the perennials, are there different requirements, I guess, for, you know, taking care of them throughout the year and then putting them to bed for the winter?
I mean, certainly, you know, when you're putting your garden to bed for the winter, I always like to sort of, you know, put a few leaves, like mulched leaves around the bottoms, do certain things to protect them. You know, and you also just want to make sure that they're in a really good spot, they're protected, you know, from the elements. And, you know, that you've chosen, like with some of the tips that I mentioned earlier, a really solid plant in the first place.
And is there a particular way that you would, you know, awaken them in the spring, like around now, like I guess being very careful to take off those leaves from the previous winter?
Yeah, I'm really careful with you know, sort of clearing away things, because sometimes, you know, you don't want to damage all those tender shoots coming up underneath, but there's really not much you need to do. Nature sort of takes its course and, you know, allows everything to come back every year. You know, with a hosta, for example, you know, there's always lots of leaves. And if I don't get to them in time, you know, they kind of mush down in the winter. So I just tenderly take those away and then let the new stuff come up.
And I guess the question, as we sort of march towards, you know, warmer weather and stuff, and I guess maybe more of an influx of bugs, are most bugs bad? Like, how do you know which ones to sort of leave alone and which ones to get the heck out of there?
Well, I mean, it's sort of hard sometimes to just look at them. I mean, that's why, you know, it is a good idea to maybe check a gardening magazine or to go online and take a look. But there are plenty of beneficial insects. You know, a lot of people are scared of bees, but bees are pollinators and really integral to our whole ecosystem. So there are a lot of really good bugs that could do wonderful things for your plants.
A question that I think a lot of us are asking right now, Tara, with all this wet and cold weather that seems to be happening in many places in North America, do gardeners have to change their strategy this year? Like, is it too wet or too cold for some of these plants and vegetables?
You know, it depends where you live. So you definitely want to sort of keep an eye on your garden. If it is like super waterlogged, you know, it might not be, you might want to wait until it dries out a little bit so you're not drowning the plants or planting in muck and that sort of thing. And definitely it might be a good idea to wait for certain things. You know, it's supposed to be nice here this weekend. I'm in Southern Ontario, but, you know, like it just depends on your situation and where you are. So unfortunately, it's been a bit of a late spring
okay.
for a lot of people.
And I guess like a, you know, for people who are, you know, again, heading out to get, I guess the majority, I wouldn't say the majority of their work done, but you know, we talked about this being planting season. Do you have any final tips for people as they sort of head out there? Because I feel like this is a time where you kind of need to be a little bit focused.
Absolutely. Well, you know, if you're sort of new in the garden and you're not sure where in the garden gets the most light, it's a good idea to maybe just take a step back and sort of measure your light conditions. And you can do that on a sunny day by, you know, sort of just charting it on graph paper where the light hits your yard at certain times of the day. So you might want to, you know, choose every few hours, like 10, 2, and 4, see what parts get the most shade and what parts get the most sun. And that will help you when you go to the nursery to pick out, you know, the plants that might work best in those conditions.
Fantastic. Tara, that's awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Anytime.
That's Tara Nolan, again, web editor for CanadianGardening.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
I'm sure you've noticed in the last several years that technology is moving faster than ever before. It seems as soon as we get used to one gadget or gizmo, the next one is already out and demanding our attention. How do you know which one to use or which one to spend your hard-earned money on? There's so many questions. Well, to help us understand what we should be aware of in this digital landscape is high-tech expert and author of the book, The Digital Mindset, Carol Ingley. Carol, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
Carol, can you give us, you know, in layman's terms, a brief description of what the digital mindset is?
The digital mindset is best described by your introduction, and that is that we are now on overwhelm. And there have been so many changes over the past 10 years as we have moved into a digital environment. And a lot of people haven't taken the time to think about just what that means, being digital. And it means that everything speaks the same language, which is ones and zeros. So there's an ability now, and this is like 5 years ago, we didn't have digital TV over the air. So a lot of these things are very new. So we are in a position where life is going to not change fast like it has been for the past 10 years, but it's going to change exponentially fast. Because now we went through all this changes to get to the point where we can mix and match everything. So now to answer your question of what the digital mindset is accepting the fact that there is so much information and that there is this ability to mix and match digits or video, data, and voice to the point where it's an overwhelming amount of information. And you have to accept that the fact that it is too much to ever get on top of. And you have to accept the fact that you are on overwhelm and there's just way too much. And once you embrace what I call it, I say embrace infinity. Once you embrace that, you walk into a new world. And that's the first step of the digital mindset, is accepting the fact that you'll never get on top of everything. And then once you do, and you walk into this new world, and then you learn the new rules of this new world, then you are a powerful person such that that we haven't even begun to understand how powerful we are as individuals.
And Carol, how do you sort of get your brain, you know, to embrace this digital mindset?
Well, there is a chapter. There's step three is to rewire your brain to the digital mindset. And what you have to do is accept the fact that you're going to have to use your whole brain. Now, women tend to be very good at using one side of their brain, which is intuitive, and it's imaginative and it's artistic. Women tend to focus more on those kinds of skills. Now, that's a generalization because that's not always true. And men tend to be logical and tend to use the left-hand side of the brain, whereas women tend to use the right-hand side of the brain. But with the digital mindset, because we'll have to learn how all of this stuff works, we have to use the analytical side of the brain. But in order to survive in this new world, and it is a very new world, we have to be creative in our thinking in order to stand out. Because everyone around us is going to be creative, so we also have to be creative. So you have to use both sides of your brain, and if you're only used to using one, you're going to have to get used to using both sides.
And, you know, I was reading through the book about the elements of the digital mindset toolbox. Can you tell us what those are?
Yes, and that's very important. And it's important to understand the elements of the digital mindset toolbox because it begins to allow you to categorize all this masses of information. If you begin to have categories, it's a lot easier to understand the whole picture. And the categories of the digital mindset toolbox are hardware, software, services, content, and accessories. And if you look at that that chapter on the digital mindset toolbox, you actually think about what Steve Jobs has been doing over the past 10 years, you will see that he's taking components out of each of these categories and mixing and matching them. So it takes some of the mystery away from Mr. Jobs, who has been obviously very brilliant, but he is really mixing and matching the landscape.
Okay.
And you can do it too. And that's what's so amazing about what we're walking into is the power that we now have as individuals, because all this technology is now at our fingertips.
For a lot of people out there, again, you know, there's so many, you know, moms and dads that are, you know, they have their job and they've got that to do, but then they come home and they have, you know, their family responsibilities. So as you mentioned earlier, there's so much and it's hard to stay on top of everything sort of technologically. Are there some key tech buzzwords that we should be aware of so that we don't get left in the dust, even if we do have all these other responsibilities in our life?
Well, you know, there are lots of buzzwords out there, but one key buzzword is the triple play. And, you know, you probably hear about it on television and stuff, but it really is very, very important. And that is to understand that there are three major services right now, and that is digital TV, broadband internet, and some kind of voice. Voice would either be landline or your cell phone. But what makes it more complicated is this is a concept that has been out there for a long time in the industry. But you now can have the triple play just on a smartphone. So now you can, the world is changing in that now you can have the digital TV, and that's just new, digital TV, broadband internet, and voice on your cell phone. But that's key. The triple play is really a key concept. And you have to, one of the most important things about the digital mindset is you have to keep going back to the basics. It is important to go back to that. Now, another key concept is 4G. You may have heard advertisements about AT&T talking about their 4G network. And 4G is nothing more complicated than fourth generation. And that simply means that it's a faster, more bandwidth kind of network that allows your video to travel at a faster pace.
Joining us on the show is high-tech expert and author of the book, The Digital Mindset, Carol Ingley. Make sure you check her out at ingleyconsultancy.com. Now, Carol, there are so many gadgets on the market right now, and it seems that just as soon as we get used to one thing, another one comes out. I guess my question would be, you know, what are some of the best devices out there, and how do we choose which one is right for our lifestyle? For example, you know, do you go with the iPhone or the BlackBerry? Because I find certain people, it does lend itself, you know, to one or the other.
Okay, well, that's an excellent question. And really, that's when you have to go back to the basics. And the basics right now for in the digital mindset are three, and now really evolving to four major gadgets. And that is your digital TV, a PC that is either Windows-based or a Mac, and some kind of smartphone. So it's not, yes, there are lots of other things out there that are digital cameras. Now I'm going to say that there's a fourth that may well evolve to be as important because it fills such a gap, and that is the tablet. And we don't really have something that easily, even though laptops can be taken with you, the tablet is much easier to take with you, and it's very easy to watch video on, easier than a smartphone. So I believe the tablet is going to start to fill a bigger and bigger gap for us. But right now, you really have to stay with the basics and then work within the basics. And then you adapt those basics. You adapt the triple play and you adapt your basic gadgets to your own particular lifestyle. Now, as far as upgrading, well, obviously companies are onto this and they don't release everything at once. So they slowly release, for example, PCs will evolve and be released into stores every 3 or 4 months. So you can never keep up. So you have to decide for yourself how often you're going to upgrade. And as far as the kind of cell phone, that's quite individual. But right now, the Android and the iPhone seem to be overtaking the BlackBerry. That's what seems to be happening. But we'll see. Very competitive marketplace.
Carol, how do you know when to upgrade for yourself? Because like you said, there's all these upgrades coming out every, you know, several months. But how do you know as an individual when it's time to upgrade? Because sometimes I feel like, for example, I love my mom to pieces, but she, you know, gets sort of set in her ways and, you know, has a particular cell phone and she's quite happy to stay with that for, you know, 3-4 years. How do you know internally when you need to sort of say, you know what, I need to go to the next level and I'm not going to be afraid that I need to relearn something or learn something new?
Well, this is very individual, but a lot of it has to do with your budget. And, you know, everyone has only a certain amount of money that they can spend on digital assets. So that plays a huge role. Now, if you don't have a very tight budget, you can afford to upgrade more often. But I'm going to say I don't think you have to upgrade more often than 2 years. That's my own particular take. But it has to do with your profession. And it has to do with all your personal needs. And if you want to hang on to a cell phone for 3 years and it's something that you really like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Okay.
But there will be a point where you notice that you're not getting the features that other people are getting, and that's probably when you notice that you're not getting the features that you want is when most people upgrade.
And what do you say to someone on the other side of the spectrum, you know, like for lack of a better term, like a gadget nerd who, you know, has to have all the latest gizmos and ends up spending tons of money? And like recently, I've seen them because I was out for the iPad 2 launch here in Montreal. And, you know, there was people that had been lining up since, 3 a.m. in the morning for something that wasn't going to be released till 5 p.m. So they spent, 14 hours out in the cold. What do you say to these people? Like, do they need to calm down a little bit?
Well, in a way, I personally, out of all the things that have come out, other than when I first got my BlackBerry many years ago, I think the iPad 2 is one of the most exciting gadgets to come out. So I can see the excitement there. But I don't know what to say to that, except that I just got an iPad 2, so I maybe you used the wrong example. But I think what people do need to calm down about is that you do not want to stretch your budget.
Right.
And there is something called a wish list, and to put it on your wish list, that is, I think, very, very important, because most people do not have an unlimited amount of money to spend on digital assets.
Yeah, and I guess that was my point.
So to spend more time like planning and you know, thinking, oh, okay, I would really like this, and I'm going to explore, the different prices, and just think about having it rather than just going out and getting it immediately. But I think that there are people who buy things too quickly and then they don't use them. So you really have to really want it, I think, in this day and age, because using your digital assets is very, very important, because you can't afford to lose $1,000 here and $1,000 there.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, and I guess that's my point, because like I just see so many people. Like, for example, I was very excited as well when the original iPad came out, but I knew that I probably didn't want the first generation. So, so I've waited, and I still don't have the iPad 2 yet, but that's something that I'm sort of saving towards, for the end of the year. So I think
and that's good, and that's perfect, because you get it when you've thought about it and you've saved your money and things like that.
Yeah,
that's perfect.
Okay, and a question I would have, Carol, as well, because I hate to bring up my mother again, but she feels, and I think a lot of people feel this way, that with all the new technology, everyone says that it's supposed to save you time so that you can enjoy life, but sometimes I think my mom and other people feel like having all these tech toys actually takes away more of your time. What's your thoughts on that?
My thought is that they have a point, and that we are in this gray area where technology hasn't gotten to be that that sophisticated, so that it is as intuitive as it needs to be. Now, the iPhone and the iPad are much more intuitive than other devices, but we haven't really gotten to the stage where everything is intuitive. We're in this still in an evolution stage of technology. And also, there's something called plug and play, where you really should be able to take all your different devices and plug them into each other with ease. And so we haven't really gotten there. So we're in this kind of like really clunky stage of, we have just gotten things all digital, or most things digital. So we're in this really clunky phase where, sometimes it takes a lot more time than it should. But you kind of have to say, okay, I'm going to bear with it a little bit here, and spend a little bit extra time sometimes in learning things, knowing that in 5 to 10 years, this is going to be a lot easier to do. It's going to be far more intuitive, and it's going to be a lot easier for me to utilize all these different devices.
And what do you say to people who, I don't want to categorize, because I feel like there's some people that are in their 50s and 60s, even 70s, who are embracing technology and want to learn the new stuff. Then there's others, even people that are, I've met in my own age range in the 20s and the 30s, who don't really, like I said, it's almost like they're scared of all the new gadgets that come out. What do you tell people, with regards to embracing technology? I think some people just need to embrace it and not be afraid of it.
Right. And one of what I do is I say, read the book. Because I actually had, there was an employee at my yoga clinic who I gave a free copy to, and she read it and she said, I hate technology and I love the book. So what she was really saying to me is that she is a little afraid of all this technology, but the book gave her the feeling of power. And that's really what the point of writing this book is, to show people the power that they're going to have. Now, maybe there are going to be some difficult steps along the way, but you're ultimately heading towards a position of power.
What is the most important piece of advice that you can give a consumer when they are on the hunt for their next piece of technology? Because I don't think anyone should head out into the store or online sort of willy-nilly.
Well, I think that you should sightsee. And I think that to go into a Verizon Wireless store and just walk around and see what's there, and just be a sightseer, and just look and see what the options are, and then walk into if you have a Best Buy nearby, walk in and see what's going on. And what is important is to see that, you know, there are a lot of things in there that are accessories that are not the main deal. So, you know, get a feel for what's actually happening, and try and enjoy the process, because this, I know that this is going to put you onto a powerful path. So, and part of it is just enjoying it, because it's doable for all of us.
I think that's actually very key that you just said that word, Carol, like to enjoy it. Because, like, again, I just picture my mother. Like, I remember when I had to teach her, you know, how to use a computer. And then I remember when I had to teach her, you know, how to text message. And
right.
And her attitude, and, you know, she's a very positive person, but again, she was overwhelmed, which is a term we used before. I think she felt it, you know, more of a chore. And I think if she would embrace it, the whole experience would be much better.
Yes, and have her make sure that she makes use of the services available. For example, walking into a wireless store with your phone saying, you know what, I can't do this. Please show me how. And, you know, they'll show you how.
That's
and,
right.
You know, to call up the customer service and say, you know, I'm having trouble with this. Utilize every single helpline that there is, because, you know, if they don't explain it well enough, then you really deserve to get the help that you need.
That's amazing. And Carol, where can people get a copy of your book? Because I think it's just fantastic.
Well, it's available on Amazon. And if you go to thedigitalmindset.com, it will give you a little bit more information about the book and a link to purchase it.
Fantastic. Carol, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate that.
That's high-tech expert and author of the book, The Digital Mindset, Carol Ingley. Again, check her out at her website, ingleyconsultancy.com.
Bring on the... Remix.
Gaga with Judas, remixed by Brian Kua and Drew G on The Kelly Alexander Show. We also featured the Dixie Chicks with their hit song, Not Ready to Make Nice. Well, there we go. Another show has come to a close, but I would like to take a moment actually to make a heartfelt thank you to Maureen Santora for joining us on the show this week. I think she is an amazingly brave woman to share her personal story of her son, Christopher, and his tragic death at the Twin Towers on 9/11. And it was just a wonderful experience to speak with her. I know that, you know, so many of us, you know, paid attention to what happened on September 11th, 2001. But to actually speak to someone who was so deeply affected, it's a very, very moving experience. And I just, you know, I really appreciate Maureen taking the time to be with us on the show this week. I also want to thank our always amazing guest, Tara Nolan, as well as Carol Ingley for her insight into the world of gadgetry. Now, here's the deal. Please make sure you tune into the show next week because we have the amazing Rosie Etta from Entertainment Tonight Canada joining us on the show. She not only leads a very amazing life, you know, interviewing these A-list celebrities, but she's also a 3-time Olympian for Canada at the Summer Olympics. And I can't wait for you to hear her story. So have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.